We'd like to dedicate this song especially to the children, the Kamali'i of Hawaii'i. A special dedication to our Kamali'i in the village of Kahakuloa, situated on the northwestern side of the island of Maui. Aloha.
Nu'oli, nu'oli, he nuka maha'o, e nuno ke ola mai luna mai no.
Hello everybody, this is Oz, and you are listening to radio.dominican.edu, and this is the Sports Track Central. This is the first show of the semester, and we'll be talking about sports, college, NFL, high school. We got some segments here. The first section we're going to be talking about is boxing. Talking about Mike Tyson, I saw him on the air, talking about his promoting the debuts, and we got a statement here saying Mike Tyson found a way to bite back Thursday, sending a response to USA Boxing. President Dr. Charles F. Butler, after Butler accused Tyson of poaching potential Olympic team fighters, according to a report. USA Boxing sent an open letter to Mike Tyson asking him to wait until after the 2016 Rio Games to sign the country's top amateur fighters. In a letter which was published Thursday by the New York Post, Tyson said he was the most disappointed and accused USA Boxing of taking advantage of my name and company for publicity. Following the initial accusations from USA Boxing on Tuesday, Tyson publicist Joanne Mignano said the former heavyweight champion would not be commenting. Tyson began working as a promoter recently, joining the promotion company Equiniti Sports to host his first card last month in Verona, New York. Your organization never attempted to contact me directly to discuss this matter, Tyson wrote. Had you done so, perhaps you would have better understood my love for amateur boxing and my commitment to protect fighters by giving them the best possible opportunities this business can offer. On Tuesday, Butler sent an open letter to Tyson, a former Olympic hopeful himself, accusing recently formed Iron Mike Productions of offering money to the best amateur fighters to turn pro. In particular, top 152-pound Erickson Lubin, who some in amateur boxing say represents the country's best hope for a gold medal at the Rio Games. Butler said the money being offered is pennies on the dollar of what the prospects could be worth with an Olympic medal. Mignano confirmed that Iron Mike Productions signed the Florida fighter on his 18th birthday, which was Tuesday. Lubin is a two-time junior Olympic national champion and won the 152-pound division at the National Golden Gloves this year. In his USA Boxing bio, Lubin listed as his goals winning an Olympic gold, turning pro, and winning every title possible. Tyson defended the signing of Lubin, said it was solely his advisors and his decision to turn pro. Tyson reminded Butler in a letter that the former heavyweight champion himself turned pro at the age of 18 and had a very successful professional career. No one knows better than I the pitfalls of amateur and professional boxing, Tyson wrote. This is precisely why I'm compelled to make Iron Mike Productions a transparent company. Our priority is the well-being of our fighters and to produce the most exciting fights we can, and in the process, uplift the sport of boxing. I love my country and I love the liberties living in a democracy affords. These young fighters have worked diligently and deserve the right to pursue the best path they seem to fit themselves. Unfortunately, many of them can't wait around for a very slim shot at Olympic glory. Tyson was left off the 1984 Olympic boxing team after losing a close decision at the trials. Our country hasn't made a male boxer gold medalist since 2004, which could be why so many young hopefuls decide to turn professional sooner. Tyson wrote, many of these boxers are like me in that they are from poverty-stricken communities and boxing is the only way to a better life. They have obligations beyond your personal vision for them. No one has the right to question a path for that a fighter chooses in pursuit of their American dream. I will always be supportive of amateur boxing and will continue helping in any way possible. My door is always open to assist the USA Boxing team reaching its goals. Hopefully in the future you will be more comfortable reaching out to me directly. USA Boxing Executive Director Anthony Barkowski said his organization is looking to be more competitive. This is a new strategy of trying to make sure our Olympic-aged athletes are not poached by promoters, he said. In the past, USA Boxing was passive and just accepted it. Tyson isn't the only promoter trying to lure amateurs into the pros. Last month, DiBella Entertainment said it signed highly touted 17-year-old junior Sugar Boy Yaunin of New York to a contract and said he would make his pro debut in late October or early November after he turned 18. Boxing promoters have long trolled the amateur ranks looking for talent, especially in recent years as the lure of Olympic gold has faded for many fighters. Winning in the Olympics was once a nearly certain way to make millions, but as U.S. Olympic boxing teams have faded, so have the prospects for Olympic fighters. In Louisville, Kentucky, appearing frail, boxing legend Muhammad Ali made a rare public appearance Thursday at an event in his hometown to pay homage to others for their humanitarian work. Former President Jimmy Carter, music artists, and young leaders of groups helping the underprivileged were among those honored at the inaugural Muhammad Ali Humanitarian Awards in Louisville, Kentucky. Even though he was barely able to whisper a word, Ali posed for pictures and participated in presenting the awards. This is really about the legacy and extending that legacy to others and inspiring them and encouraging them to do the kinds of work that now he cannot do himself, Ali's wife Lonnie Ali said at the gala. While Parkinson's disease has robbed many of the traits he once treasured in the ring, the speed, the wit, the charisma that made him one of the most famous sports figures in recent history, he has never retreated from public life. His head is still there. People always feel bad when they see my dad, and I feel bad because he has Parkinson's disease and it's hard for him to get around. But he is happy, said his daughter, Layla Ali, who retired as an undefeated as a super middleweight champion. His head is still there, and all we can do is keep loving him and supporting him, even though it's never been easy to watch. Recipients of the Muhammad Ali Humanitarian Award include 22-year-old Tanvi Jirtora of India, who leads a global youth organization that seeks to combat sex trafficking and empower women. Walking along the red carpet to greet Ali, 71, was 15-year-old Nick Lowinger of Rhode Island, who began outreach work with homeless people at the age of 5. Lowinger was recognized for his foundation, which provides shoes to more than 10,000 homeless and disadvantaged children in 21 states. Nobody had to ask them to do it. They recognized the need, and they jumped to action just to recognize that somebody needed something, said Lonnie Ali. Carter, who turned 89 on Tuesday, was singled out for a Lifetime Achievement Award. The 39th U.S. president was unable to attend, so his son, James Chip Carter, accepted the award. Pop stars recognized. Also, other pop singers who have done their humanitarian work was Christina Aguilera and Michael Bolton, honored for his work promoting gender equality. Sports news. San Francisco 49ers had planned to stash quarterback B.J. Daniels on their practice squad, but the Seahawks had other plans, grabbing him the waivers. The Seattle Seahawks and San Francisco 49ers are even this fall when it comes to claiming each other's draft choice. Seattle now has a third quarterback. Having claimed rookie B.J. Daniels, the 49ers' seventh-round draft pick out of South Florida, off waivers Wednesday. To make room, the Seahawks released rookie linebacker John Luatoli. San Francisco head coach Jim Harbaugh made it clear that the 49ers valued Daniels and had every intention of signing them to their practice squad. The team cut him in favor of John Skelton, believing the veteran's quarterback experience would benefit the 53-year-old man roster at this point. We have a plan for him here, Harbaugh said of Daniels before Seattle's claim. Apparently so do the Seahawks, and now they know the feeling of losing a guy they wanted to keep around. Before the season, Seattle released receiver Chris Harper, a fourth-round draft pick, hoping to add him to the practice squad. Instead, the 49ers added them to their 53-man roster. Daniel said he was so surprised that he was placed on waiver by the 49ers. I've never gone through this. To be picked up by Seattle is a blessing, he said. He said he doesn't view his acquisition by Seattle as a way for the Seahawks to get revenge on the 49ers for claiming Harper. I don't agree with all of that. During my draft process, I had Seattle come out and work out with me. This is one of the places where I thought I might be drafted. I'm glad it worked out here, he said. Daniel said he wouldn't allow himself to get caught up in the intense rivalry between the team's fans. That whole rivalry with the fans is not something I can pay attention to right now, he said. This is my new home, and whatever I can do to help out Seattle is what I need to do. All right, we're going to take a little break here, and we're going to go on to our next segment, which we're going to talk about the USC happenings with Lane Kiffin, and we're going to go ahead and take a break. This is DJ Oz at radio.dominican.edu. Again, everybody, this is Oz, and you are listening to ProTrack Central at radio.dominican.edu. It is 10:14 right now, and we are in the studio, and we're going to talk a little bit about we're going to listen to another song, but I'm going to turn that off right now. We're going to talk about what's happening in Southern California with the USC coach Lane Kiffin. In Los Angeles Sunday morning, ending the coach's tumultuous tenure a few hours after the Trojans lost 62-41 at Arizona State. Ed Orgeron was picked as USC's interim head coach by athletic director Pat Hayden, who dismissed Kiffin at the airport following the Trojans' flight home. USC 3-2, 0-2 in the Pac-12, has 8 games left under Orgeron, Kiffin's assistant head coach and the former Mississippi head coach. "It's never been the perfect time to do these things, but I thought it was the right time," Hayden said. Hayden had fired Kiffin in a 3 a.m. meeting at the Trojans' private airport terminal, but not before a 45-minute chat in which Kiffin tried to change Hayden's mind. First, I thought this was, at LAX, in the terminal. You wonder what conversation really went on between Kiffin and the head coach. Was he promising that he was going to do better? He just left. USC is known for its defense in the past, but in the last 4 years, a lot of changes have been going on, and Kiffin, this was a long, he should have seen this one coming. So, it was actually at the private airport terminal. I thought it was in the middle of LAX, and basically, try not before a 45-minute chat in which Kiffin tried to change his mind. He probably begged him, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. But once the owners and the management have made up their mind, there's no talking them out of it. So I wonder where he's going to go next. Poor guy. He didn't last long with Oakland in 2008, too. He was only there for 20 games before his disputes with Al Davis. But they decided to hire him because I'm sure it's a lot of money. A lot of money to the program, the USC program. But Hayden didn't hire Kiffin, but he'd been firmly behind the coach until Saturday when the Trojans matched the most points allowed in school history. The loss was the 7th in 11 games for a whole high-profile program still struggling under the cumulative effect of NCAA sanctions. "He did a lot of things well under some very difficult circumstances here," Hayden said. "No one could have worked harder. He did a lot of things we asked." Graduate players never had compliance issues, and we really worked under some very difficult NCAA sanctions. There's no doubt about it. USC must finish an already disappointing season without Kiffin while looking at another coach to reboot its proud program. The Trojans are off this week before returning October 10th at the Coliseum against Arizona. Kiffin went 28-15 in parts of 4 seasons in a self-described dream job, but USC is 0-2 in conference play for the first time since 2001 after losses to Arizona State and Washington State, and the record only partly captures the discontent of USC fans and alumni. The Trojans were unimpressive on offense, even in their 3 victories this season, stoking discontent around a school with sky-high expectations despite the tail end of heavy NCAA sanctions, penalties stemming from coach Pete Carroll's tenure. Kiffin received withering criticism for persisting in calling the Trojans' offensive plays himself well into the school's second straight poor offensive season. The Trojans lost their home opener 10-7 to the unheralded Cougars earlier this month, and Coliseum fans serenaded USC repeatedly with chants of "Fire Kiffin." USC has been in a slow tailspin since going 10-2 and beating Oregon in 2011, the last year of its bowl ban. After starting as the preseason number one last year, the Trojans finished 7-6 out of the rankings, followed by the season's disappointments. "I think it could easily be asked, why not last year after a 7-6 season?" Hayden said. "What do you know now that you didn't know after the 7-6 season?" The rationale was the prior year. Lane had won 10 games. "We thought and were hoping that last year was an aberration. We felt we could rebound, make some changes, and indeed, Lane did. But at the end of the day, we just weren't making the progress. I felt we needed a change." The firing comes less than 5 months after Hayden said Kiffin has been as good as he can be in the face of USC sanctions. Before this season began, Hayden said he was 100% behind the embattled Kiffin. We support our coaches 100% until they're no longer our coaches, Hayden said. Why would you support an 85% coach? The 52-year-old Ogeron went 10-25 in three seasons at Ole Miss, but that failed tenure did little to diminish his stature as a Bulldog recruiter and defensive line coach. He coached alongside Kiffin at Tennessee before following his friend back to USC. Oregon, a Louisiana native with a thick Cajun accent, might sound a little bit out of place in Los Angeles, but he's a popular assistant coach and a USC devotee after 11 years over two tenures at the school. It's an unfortunate day that a coach got let go, but we understand the circumstances, Ogeron said. I want to tell you, we're here as a staff to answer the bell. We're all accountable for what has happened, and as a staff and as players. Us Trojans know how to do it. Ogeron said Clay Hilton will be his offensive coordinator and the Trojans' play caller, Helton. USC's quarterback coach and passing game coordinator has been with the Trojans since Kiffin returned in 2010. Most players found out about Kiffin's dismissal by text messages in the middle of the night. The players have the next 2 days off before returning to practice Wednesday. We'll try to move forward now and focus on these next 8 games, really bonding as a Trojan family and getting these wins, offensive lineman Marcus Martin said. Like the precocious Kiffin's other two head coaching jobs, his USC tenure had been an abrupt, messy exit. Former USC athletic director Mike Garrett hired Kiffin away from Tennessee to replace Seattle Seahawks coach Carroll, the architect of USC's dynasty over the previous decade. Kiffin was an assistant under Carroll, eventually running the Trojans' offense alongside Steve Sarkisian, now Washington's coach. All right, we're going to take a little break here, and this is... When we come back, we're going to talk about prospects for the USC as far as recruitment. And we're going to go on to our next segment. We're going to take a little break here. And you are listening to radio.dominican.edu. And this is ProTrack Central. And we are going to take a little break here.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody, this is DJ Oz, and we are back. And you are listening to Pro Track Central at Dominican, radio.dominican.edu. And we were talking about in our last segment about the USC firing of Coach Lane Kiffin and how that abruptly ended at the airport terminal. I wonder where he's going to go next. But it's a big deal, everybody. You know, I mean, it sounds funny and you know, that. You know, but it's a tremendous, tremendous responsibility for a head coach, especially with the history of USC. You know, going from the Raiders and everything. You know, it really, really takes guts. So, you know, I really have to commend them. But, you know, the organization, whether it be Oakland Raiders or the USC Trojans, you know, they got to do the right thing and they got to win. And you know, at the bottom line, you know, they allowed 62 points against Arizona. You know, with the history of USC's defense, you know, that's not very good. So hopefully the offensive coordinator Ed Orgeron will take over for the final 8 games of the season. But that's not the only thing going on. There's been accusations and reprimands, you know, on the USC and all over the leagues. But last year, USC, you know, fired a manager for deflating footballs used in the game. You know, the coaches said they had, and staff administrators had no knowledge of, you know, the manager's actions, which reportedly took place after the game's game officials tested the balls well before the kickoff. The Pac-12 accepted USC's self-discipline, and on Wednesday, and added a $25,000 fine to the football program, which is really nothing, but it really says a lot. You know, we acknowledge the Pac-12's reprimand and fine, USC Athletic Director Pat Hayden said. We regret this incident occurred. It was unacceptable, and we apologize for it. I can assure you this will not happen again. USC coach Lane Kiffin said the compliance department researched the situation and concluded that the manager acted alone. Maybe this guy thought he was helping out the team, you know, by deflating the ball. Well, with deflating the ball, you're not able to pass. You know, if they're going to run the ball, you know, and this is what I think, if they're going to run the ball, from my experience, they could hold on to the ball better. But this is just a poor decision on the manager, you know, because that goes for both teams. You know, he could have helped. Maybe he thought he was helping out the USC, you know, the USC offense and. It just really doesn't make any difference. It just made him really look bad. So, Senior Vice President in Russillo said Scott Van Pelt details the firing of a student manager at USC for deflating the balls. Van Pelt said this is the latest example of fishy behavior by Lane Kiffin. So maybe he had something to do with that. Snoop Dogg's son, Snoop Dogg, Cordell Broaddus, a USC prospect and the number 6 high school wide receiver in the nation, according to 247 Sports, approved the move of firing Lane Kiffin. That's pretty gutsy for him to come out, but then again, it's, you know, Snoop Dogg's son. He can really do whatever he wants. I wonder if it's just really a coincidence that, you know, that he's the number 6 wide receiver in the nation. You know, that's... It goes to show, you know, what kind of support that he has, and I see a pattern with these athletes, you know, where to be. You know, there's outliers everywhere, and but for this kid to come out and be a prospect at USC, and he's got many schools looking at him, for him to come out and make the statement, you know, he was just raised with confidence and raised well, and. It's still a pretty gutsy move, you know, being Snoop Dogg. How cool would that be? You know, be at practice. He's a kid still in high school. To be at practice, you know, and have your dad, Snoop Dogg, be at the practice. And that would be the coolest thing in the world. But this is what he said. This is Snoop Dogg's son, Cordell Broaddus, said, I feel that he should have been fired a while ago, and USC is going to raise the bar now because the new coaching staff next year, and I am anxious to see what they are going to look like. So more likely, you know, when once his son Cordell Broaddus graduates, he probably ended up going to USC, which Snoop Dogg's a big fan. And I looked at it, and this son's not that big, not that tall. He's 6'1". And Snoop Dogg's pretty tall. And he's only about 185 pounds, but he must be one good athlete, if he's number six in the country. All right. You know, back to the news about the private airport terminal and the chat that Kiffin had and changing Hayden's mind. Of course, I'm sure he sat down and said, you know, well, this is what's been happening, and we acknowledge this, and we're going to fix it, but there's no change in their minds. Once they sit you down, they've had their minds set. So, all right, in other sports news, last week, Pittsburgh Steelers, L.C. Greenwood, who helped the Pittsburgh Steelers win four Super Bowl titles in the 1970s and was a member of the famed Steel Curtain defensive line, died of natural causes Sunday at UPMC Presbyterian Hospital. He was 67 years old. L.C. Greenwood was part of four title-winning teams in Pittsburgh, including the Super Bowl 24 against the Los Angeles Rams. Greenwood is the second on the Steelers' all-time sacks list, 73.5, made four Pro Bowls, and was two-time first-team All-Pro selection during a career that spanned from 1969 to 1981. He had four sacks in the Steelers' 21-17 win against the Cowboys in Super Bowl X. His death leaves Joe Green as the lone surviving member of the Steel Curtain, which also included Dwight White and Ernie Holmes. L.C. was one of the most beloved Steelers during the most successful period in team history, and he will be missed by the entire organization, Steelers President Art Rooney II and Chairman Emeritus Dan Rooney said in a joint statement released by the team Sunday. He will be forever remembered for what he meant to the Steelers both on and off the field. A 10th round draft pick out of Arkansas AM&N, now Arkansas Pine Bluff, in 1969, Greenwood is a member of a small number of small school prospects who rose to prominence while helping the Steelers go from perennial also-rans to world champions. Four players from that defense and nine players from those teams, as well as Coach Chuck Knoll, are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Greenwood has long been prominent on the list of players that had Hall of Fame credentials that never made it to Canton, Ohio. Hall of Fame cornerback Mel Blount said recently that Greenwood is among a handful of Steelers from the 1970s team who should be in the Hall of Fame. Why is Larry Brown not in there? Why is L.C. Greenwood not in there? Blount said. I think once they get so many in there, they start saying, well, we've got enough Steelers. Knee problems forced Greenwood to retire before the 1982 season. His 13 years in Pittsburgh are tied to the third longest tenure with the team in franchise history. Greenwood remained in Pittsburgh after his retirement, working as an entrepreneur and motivational speaker. Oh, and college sports here. Ole Miss players disrupt campus theater with borderline hate speech. This is, yeah, you think you, just college players, you know, would have some respect, but not in this case. This is just a, this is just an outright, you know, a disgrace. But Ole Miss football players heckled theater performers with homosexual slurs during a show put on by Ole Miss Theater Department on Tuesday night. The school student newspaper, The Daily Mississippian, reports. The play entitled The Laramie Project was based on a story of Matthew Shepard, an openly gay male student at the University of Wyoming who was murdered in Laramie County, Wyoming in 1999. The players in attendance reportedly became so disrupted that the performers had trouble finishing the play. According to the play's director and theater faculty member Rory Ledbetter, some audience members used derogatory slurs like fag and heckled both cast members and the characters they were portraying for their body types and sexual orientations. Ledbetter said the audience reactions include borderline hate speech. And the only gay person on the cast, junior theater major Garrison Gibbons said, I played a gay character in the show, and to be ridiculed like that was something that really made me realize that some people at Ole Miss and in Mississippi still can't accept me for who I am. According to the Daily Mississippian, many of the players were in attendance as a requirement for a freshman-level theater course. Reports indicated that players were taking pictures of cast members while making fun of them, talking on their cell phones. hollering at the females in the cast and talking to other audience members. After the Ole Miss athletic department was informed of the players' behaviors, the team members in attendance were asked to apologize to the cast after the show. One undisclosed player offered an apology for the entire group. I have been acting for 7 or 8 years, and a lot of that has been in front of young children, sophomore theater major Rachel Stanton said. That was by far the worst audience I've ever performed in front of. It wasn't all football players, but they seemed to be the leaders. If I can go support and respect the football team in their stadium, I feel like they should be able to support and respect me and my fellow cast members when we are doing a show. The Ole Miss athletic department offered no comment to the Daily Mississippian, but an athletic department official did issue an apology via email to the theater department. On Thursday, Rebels head coach Hugh Freeze issued a statement regarding the allegations on Twitter. Also at Mississippi State University, LSU to pipe in the cowbell sounds. LSU needs more cowbell. Trevor Maddich discussed LSU coach Les Miles' statement that they need to pump up in cowbell sounds during practice in order to prepare for their game against Mississippi State. LSU coach Les Miles had an idea to combat the noise when his team visits Mississippi State. More cowbell. The Tigers, coming off a 44-41 loss to Georgia, have been preparing for Saturday's game by pumping in loud rap music during practice. However, Miles knows from experience that if the home crowd gets riled up, his players will be hearing a different jingle. We're thinking that piping in cowbells is something we need to run Thursday, Miles told the New Orleans Times. We piped in music pretty hard. Maybe the cowbells need a little tuning up. Why cowbell? According to the university's website, the cowbell is the most unique and certainly the most resounding symbol of Mississippi State University. According to the university's website, the cowbell is the most unique and certainly the most resounding symbol. The team understands its need to improve, Miles told the Times. There was a great effort collectively to operate that way against Georgia. They're a personal responsibility that takes place when a group of men finish second in a contest. Everybody has a little need to play well to perform his role. After falling four spots in the rankings to number 10, LSU 4-1 will look to get well against a program that has beaten in 20 of the past 21 games and 13 in a row. The defense might be facing two quarterbacks Saturday, though, and it's unclear who will start for the Bulldogs following their bye week. Senior Tyler Russell, who threw for 2,897 yards and 24 touchdowns last year, has been cleared to return after suffering a concussion in a season-opening loss to Oklahoma State. But sophomore Dak Prescott has played well in his place and is a better dual threat. Don't expect the Tigers to look past one another. Despite its loss to Georgia, LSU can win the Western Division without any help. I'll make reference to the big picture, Miles said. More than anything, it's the short term. The most important need is to get us squared away and looking forward to his team. In the WNBA, player Margo Dydek has died after suffering a heart attack a week ago and being placed in a medical-induced coma. She was 37 years old. Kathy Roberts, the operation manager for the Northside Wizards and Queensland Basketball League, where Dydek was a head coach, told the Associated Press that Dydek had died early Friday. The Poland-born Dydek, who was pregnant with her third child, suffered a heart attack on May 19th and collapsed at her home in Brisbane. Roberts said that Dydek was at an early stage in her pregnancy and that her unborn child had also died. Dydek was a number one pick in the 1998 WNBA draft by the Utah Stars. She also played for San Antonio, Connecticut, and Los Angeles. The 7'2" Dydek was once said to be the tallest active professional female basketball player in the world. That's very tall, considering that the average height of an NBA player is approximately 6 foot, 5'11". I think the second one is 7'1". I think that's the next tallest. But Dydek held the record for most blocks in WNBA career, 877 in 323 games, and she led the leagues in blocks 9 times from 1998 to 2003 and again from 2005 to 2007. On August 27, 2008, Dydek signed with the Los Angeles Sparks following time away from basketball due to the birth of her first son in April 2008. An entry on Dydek's Facebook said she was born on April 28, 1974 in Warsaw, Poland, to a 6'7" father and a 6'3" mother. She had two sisters, and her elder sister, Kashka, used to play for the Colorado Explosion of the now-defunct ABL and in Poland. Tina Thompson, a former teammate of Dydek's on the Sparks, said that the WNBA's Twitter fed, "My condolences to the families of Margot Dydek. May she rest in peace." The Brisbane-based Wizards posted a statement on their website Friday. "Always in our hearts, Margot," it said. "With great sadness, we acknowledge the passing of Margot Dydek. Margot suffered a heart attack just over a week ago and passed away Friday the 27th on May, peacefully surrounded by her family. You are a much-loved member of our community, and you will be missed greatly. Our hearts go out to your family, David and your beloved boys." She is survived by her husband, David, and 2 sons, David 3 and Alex 7 months. All right, we're going to go ahead and we're going to take another break here. When we come back, we're going to discuss a little bit more in sports. And this is Oz, and you are listening to ProTrack Central at radio.dominican.edu. Hey everybody, this is Oz, and you're listening to ProTrack Central at radio.dominican.edu. All right, we just came back from talking about WNBA player Margot Dydick. She passed away, and condolences to her and her family. And let's move on. We're moving on to the New York, September 25th. Chicago Sky Center Sylvia Fowles and Phoenix Mercury guard Tiana Taurasi headlined the 2013 All-WNBA First Team. The WNBA announced Friday. Fowles was the leading vote getter, 167 points, followed by Taurasi, 162, who earned a record-tying eighth first-team nod. A pair of Minnesota Lynx forward Maya Moore and guard Lindsay Whalen and Los Angeles Sparks forward Candace Parker in the 2013 WNBA MVP round out the first team. Parker is the only first team returnee from 2012. First team member in 2004, 2006, 2011. Taurasi ties Lisa Leslie for the first team selections in WNBA history, while this marks the third first team honor for both Parker and Whalen, and the second for Fowles. It is a first for Moore, who is a member of the second team a year ago. Voting for the all WNBA first and second teams was conducted by a panel of 39 national and local sports writers and broadcasters at the conclusion of the regular season. Players were selected by position and received 5 points for each first team vote and 3 points for a second team designation. Fowles, the two-time WNBA Defensive Player of the Year, led the WNBA in rebounding, finished second in blocks, and was one of only two players to average a double-double on the season, finishing with a scoring average of 16.3 points. Fowles captured the WNBA Eastern Conference Player of the Month honors in July, August, and September, as the Sky finished with a record 24-10, good for the top seed in the Eastern Conference as Chicago reached the postseason for the first time in franchise history. Taurasi finished second in the league in both scoring and assists in 2013 while guiding Phoenix into the playoffs as the number 3 seed in the Western Conference. The Mercury opens play in Western Conference Finals tomorrow against top seed Lynx at the Target Center. Parker, who also earned MVP honors as a rookie in 2008, guided the Sparks to a 24-10 record, tied for the second best mark in the league as Los Angeles secured the number 2 seed in the Western Conference playoffs. She ranked 4th in the WNBA in blocks, 6th in scoring, 7th in rebounding and double-doubles, and 12th in assists. The runner-up to Parker in the 2000 MVP voting, Moore helped Minnesota to the league's best record, 26-8, and the top overall seed in the playoffs. Moore led the WNBA in 3-point field goal percentage and in 3-point shots made, and ranked 3rd in scoring. She also finished 6th in steals and 7th in free throw percentage and 15th in rebounds. Whalen, an all WNBA second team selection a year ago, averaged a career high 14.9 points per game, good for the 15th in the league. She also ranked 3rd in assists, 5.8 average points per game, the second best figure of her career, and contributed an average 4.4 rebounds. The Indiana's Fever, Tamika Catchings, and WNBA Rookie of the Year, Alina Del Donne of the Chicago Sky, were voted as forwards on the 2013 All-WNBA Second Team. In honor of being named to the All-WNBA First and Second Teams, each player will receive a Tiffany & Company design trophy. In addition, $10,000 will be awarded to each member of the first team, while each member of the second team will receive $5,000. In other news, in Atlanta, former WNBA star and Olympic gold medalist Shamik Holtzclaw is in custody after being accused of shooting into a woman's car after using a bat to break its windows. Atlanta police said Thursday that the incident happened Tuesday after Holtzclaw followed a 29-year-old Jennifer Lacey to her car. Lacey plays for the Tulsa Shock. Shamik Holtzclaw is wanted by Atlanta police in connection with an incident involving her and a woman described as a former girlfriend. No one was injured. Lacey identified the 35-year-old Holtzclaw as an ex-girlfriend, and both played for the Atlanta Dream in 2009. Holtzclaw was in custody Thursday Thursday night in Fulton County Jail. Her bond was set at $10,000 on one charge each of aggravated assault, second-degree criminal damage, and reckless conduct. A number of holds call listed in the police report went to voicemail, and it was unknown whether she had an attorney. In women's volleyball, Washington gets top spot for first time in 8 years. Wisconsin enters the rankings. Seattle, coming off a pair of wins to start the Pac-12 play, Washington moved up to the top spot in the latest American Volleyball Coaches Association Top 25, released on Monday afternoon. It is the first time the Huskies have held the number one ranking since the 2005 season. Helping the Huskies reach the top spot was junior Krista Vincent, who was named the Pac-12 Offensive Player of the Week on Monday, the second time she's earned the honor during the past 3 weeks. Washington was ranked number two last week, but then number one Penn State suffered a loss last week while the Huskies earned a 3-0 win at previously unbeaten Washington State and then defeated number 21 Oregon 3-1 in Eugene, Oregon. The Huskies have 38 of the 61st place votes this week, though 17 different teams are receiving at least one first place vote. Pac-12 rival Southern California is now number two with 12 first-place votes. Florida is ranked third. Texas comes in fourth. Then Penn State at number five. The rest of the top ten follows as number six Hawaii, number seven Stanford, number eight Minnesota, number nine Michigan State, and number 10 Nebraska. Van Sant puts up 30 kills in the last two wins last week, hitting .348 to earn her second Offensive Player of the Week honor this season and the fourth of her career. She last won the award on September 16th. Van Sant also won three Pac-12 Freshman of the Week honors in 2011. This is the third season that the conference has had separate weekly awards for offensive, defense, and Freshman of the Week. In the conference opener at Washington State on Wednesday, Van Sant had 13 kills and 25 attempts with just two errors to hit, .440, also adding three digs and four blocks as University of Washington gave Wisconsin State its first loss. 2 days later, facing the third largest crowd in Oregon history of 4,668, Van Sant had a team-high 17 kills on a .295 attack percentage as the Huskies knocked off the 21st-ranked Ducks in four sets. Van Sant added seven digs as a seven-season best five blocks. Van Sant averaged 4.29 kills, 1.43 digs, 1.29 blocks, and 5.14 points per set on the week. Our last story on this last segment. After the Dodgers game, a death, an arrest, and outrage. Arrest has been made in the stabbing death after a Wednesday game. The Los Angeles Dodgers and San Francisco Giants have an intense rivalry. The victim is the son of a Dodgers security guard. An arrest has been made in the stabbing death of a man who was apparently killed in an argument stemming from a long, intense West Coast baseball rivalry. A few hours after the Los Angeles Dodgers and the San Francisco Giants played at AT&T Park in San Francisco on Wednesday night, a man wearing a Dodgers gear was stabbed and killed in a fight. It happened just a few blocks from the stadium, authorities said. The victim was identified as Jonathan Denver, 24, the son of a Dodgers security guard. Michael Montgomery, 21, of Lodi, California, has been charged with one count of homicide, San Francisco police said Thursday. It's not clear how the fight started, police said, but the suspect was part of a group that wasn't at the game. The Giants defeated the Dodgers 6-4 in the Wednesday night game. The fact that anybody got into any sort of beef over the Giants and the Dodgers and somebody lost their life is just senseless, said San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr. In a prepared statement, the Giants called the incident horrific. The club held a moment of silence for Denver before a Thursday night game, and police bulked up security. As Dodgers' statement said, the pain that this has caused the family and friends is unimaginable. The brother of the Los Angeles said to police that the brawl was sparked by a long-running Dodgers-Giants rivalry. He said he swung a chair at the suspect during the fight. Robert Priest Jr. told San Francisco-based KGO-TV that he was protecting his brother after another larger group of people came up behind him, the station reported Thursday. He described the chair he swung was an aluminum beach chair that was a gift from his father from Dodger Stadium. Police say that Denver's group, many wearing Dodgers garbs, got into a shouting match over the Dodgers with the suspect, 21-year-old Michael Montgomery, and a group of people he was with. at least one of them who was wearing a Giants cap a few blocks away. Montgomery's father, Marty, said his son was jumped during the fight and stabbed Denver in self-defense after Denver and others yelled, "Giants suck." The father told Lodi News Sentinel that his son said Denver hit him over the head with a chair during the fight. Oh, and that is it, and that concludes our broadcast for ProTrack Central at radio.dominican.edu. This is Oz, and thanks for listening, and tune in every Fridays at 10 a.m. to hear the latest and greatest news at radio.dominican.edu.